Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Scott Thompson. I'm here on behalf of the petitioner and others like her to demonstrate why Ms. Wintikanek deserves relief from her sentence through habeas corpus. The first question I'd like to address is whether habeas should be available to her. As I briefed, the question for relief on cases that are final is straightforward. Decisions that are substantive should be given retrospective effect. And I think respondent and petitioner agree the decision in Bazell was substantive, affecting the very reach and punishment that the statute prescribes. It's clear to me that relief should be available to the petitioner because of the court's decision in the Turner case and the cases that followed from Turner. In particular, I draw the court's attention to the Court of Appeals decision in Thornton versus Denny. In that case, a man had been convicted of an enhanced form of driving while revoked. The Turner decision clarified just what qualified as a prior conviction, and petitioner was granted relief, though his claim of relief came several years after Turner had been decided. When the petitioner and I looked at the Thornton case, we decided it was exactly like her case. Mr. Thornton was entitled to relief because the law had been clarified in Turner. In the same way, the stealing statute has been clarified in the Bazell case, the enhancement provision of which is keeping Ms. Wintikanek in prison. Since petitioner and I raised the obvious import of the Thornton versus Denny decision, respondent has attempted to wall it off or distinguish it or reconcile it with this court's other decisions. In the respondent's answer to the writ, she announced a general rule concerning retroactive application that it was available to cases that, it was available in cases that were final when the new decision helped the person claiming relief, and the law was abundantly clear prior to the decision. And I think, though I can't find a particular recitation of that principle in case law, we think that's a fine standard because we think the petitioner meets that standard. She obviously would benefit from the decision in Bazell, and as the court said repeatedly in the Bazell case, the language of the statute was indeed very clear.
Counselor, what is your claim, which is basically that the sentence imposed was in excess of the maximum authorized by law? Why isn't it waived because you didn't bring it in a 2915 motion?
Because it's a sentencing defect of the sort that habeas is designed to address, such as in State ex rel Koster versus Jackson, where the state made that very complaint that Mr. Mitchell, who was the subject of that proceeding, that Mr. Mitchell shouldn't have gotten relief because he had not filed an authorized post-conviction motion. But the Western District of the Court of Appeals said, no, this is the sort of thing that habeas is designed to affect.
And didn't this court hold it in the Zina case, where we held that if you're sentenced beyond the amount permitted by law, that is akin to a jurisdictional defect,
and precisely,
you can always raise it in habeas.
It did. Habeas is designed for this sort of case when there's been a clarification of the law. And I think to suggest that a sweeping change like this is restricted to sort of prospective relief only would really eviscerate the sort of need for habeas in a great many cases.
Well, Thornton said that it's not actually, if all you're doing is clarifying existing law, you don't really have a question of retroactivity. You're simply saying what the law is. And then you have the question, can it be raised in habeas or not, that you have to answer, which Judge Fisher just asked about. But that the retroactivity analysis doesn't really apply when you're not making a change in the law, but you're simply clarifying what the law always was.
Right. And I think that's the proper analysis. It was the analysis applied by the Thornton court. I mean, it can't be otherwise. I mean, the Zell case did nothing other than clarify what the stealing statute said by reference to the plain language of the statute.
What about the state didn't argue in Zina that the post-conviction rule applied, did they? There's no discussion of 2915 or 24035 in the Zina case.
I don't believe that they did.
That's the case where the oral pronouncement was the written judgment. So there wasn't. There's no discussion in that case that I recall where the state raised the issue or the court was presented with whether or not it was barred by failure to bring.
No, I don't believe there was in Zinnia, but there certainly it was an issue in Coster versus Jackson, and I don't know if that case, if application of transfer was made in that case, but I think that ruling by the Western District, which was I think followed in January in the Culp case that is now up in this court, Culp versus Lawrence, where that court addressed the very issues that this court is confronting today, that, you know, whether this should be available for convictions that are final and whether it applies to offenses like stealing over $500, stealing over $25,000.
Let's go a little deeper.
Sure.
As whether that Bazell should even govern this case. That this case, actually, the defendant was convicted of a subsection of the statute that had an actual requirement of value of the item stolen. So can this case be distinguished from the ruling in Bazell, and is the legislature's intent to make that a crime apparent when you read the statute as a whole and read the language in context?
My answer would be no. I don't think that the devil in the Bazell case, the defect was with that prologue to subsection 3 that described any offense in which the value of the goods or services is an element. And the court recognized that this any offense was referring back to the stealing offense as defined in subsection 1 of the statute. And indeed, all the districts of the Court of Appeals that have likewise addressed this issue have come to the same conclusion that this preface or this prologue to subsection 3 does not somehow meld with one of its subparts to create a crime of stealing something of value.
Can you address the argument made by the state? I believe in this case, I'm sure you all have read the briefs in all the cases, that a sentencing factor and an element really are different ways of referring to the same thing. That in Ring and Apprendi and Hearst and all that line of cases, the U.S. Supreme Court has said you look at the function of the required finding, and if it's in effect an element, if you have to find it in order to increase punishment, then even if it's called a sentencing factor or an enhancement, it's an element and you treat it as such. If that's the case, and that is the case in terms of sentencing, why wouldn't it be the case here also?
I think it is exactly the case here. It is an element. I mean,
somebody's making comments on it.
The state or the respondent did me a great service by pointing out, you know, the reason for, you know, their understanding of the reason for the amendment in 2002 that created this problem that the court is now having to deal with, and it was a way to make that they were at least trying to make clear that these 18 subparts were now elements of the offense of felony stealing. But though that might have been in their intent, they went about it the wrong way. I think one of the clearest points I can make about the stealing statute and why their argument that that these two factors don't combine is that the legislature has indeed altered the statute. They have amended it. If the language was sufficient to create the crime of stealing of something of value, then why would they have altered
it? But if you look at the U.S. Supreme Court cases such as Apprendi, it's not a question of what the legislature intended. If it's necessary to be found in order for you to be convicted of the offense, it must be found by the jury because it is, in fact, an element. It's not what the legislature intended to call it.
Right.
It's that, in fact, it functions as an element, and therefore you have to find it the way you have to find an element. And if that's true in those cases, why would it not be true here?
I don't think it's not true. It's just that, you know, that the attempt to make it an element was faulty and invades that. I mean, I guess I'm not doing justice to your
your
question.
Do have to find it in order to impose a felony punishment. The jury would have to find that it was over the statutory limit, $500. You couldn't have the judge find that. So it functions as an element for purpose of protecting the defendant from making sure the jury finds everything necessary to conviction. What is the philosophical, theoretical, principled basis for changing that and not treating it as an element then for this purpose?
Well, because of the sort of clear language of the statute. I mean, that it attempts to tack on an element to the core offense of stealing, but it does so by this unusual language of saying, you know, any offense in which value is an element. So the respondent's argument is that this at once refers back to the stealing offense defined in subsection 1 and also adds an element.
Clearly in Zell, the requirement of a firearm had no relation to value. Here, the requirement that it be property of $500 or more has a value in that element. And if one, our intent is to determine what the intent of the legislature was by looking at the language of the statute, should we assume the legislature wanted to make an offense, a felony offense, if it was property of greater than 500, or can we not tell that from the statute?
We can't tell it. I mean, the court's first obligation is to look at the plain language of the statute and what it says and how it says it. To the extent that we have to evaluate the intent of the legislature, that's a secondary question. We can't get past the initial question of what does the statute say? It refers to an offense that doesn't exist, an offense that has a stealing offense that has value as an element.
You also, though, do not read any sentence or any phrase in a statute in isolation. You read all of them in the entire statute. And so if one reads subsection 1 and 3 together and attempts to harmonize them, if one finds that there is some ambiguity when you read it in context, in the circumstance where it is a property taken had a value, does that allow us then to determine what the legislature's intent would be?
Again, I would say no, because as with legislative intent, I mean, I see my time's out, but as with legislative intent, we don't need to resort to tools of statutory construction if the language is clear. And the any offense, as to my understanding, refers back to the core offense of stealing described in paragraph 1, just as this court looked back to the core offense of stealing in paragraph 1 when it made its decision in Bazell and said, mm-hmm. We can't find an element of value here.
Thank you. Your time is up. We'll hear from you on your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. I'd like to begin by leaving where the petitioner left off, which is with the plain language of this statute, because I think the central instruction of the Bazell case, reaffirming this Court's jurisprudence, is that the plain language of the statute is the first thing that this Court turns to in addressing this specific interpretive question, which is essentially a linguistic question as whether or not this plain language creates a Class C felony when it establishes stealing of property worth between $500 and $25,000. The threshold requirement for a crime to satisfy this is set forth in the sort of threshold provision in subsection 3, and that says that any offense in which the value of property or services is an element is a Class C felony if, and then subparagraph 1, the value of property or services appropriated is $500 or more or less than $25,000. So the questions presented to the court interpretively are, what is the meaning of the word element, and what is the meaning of the word offense? You know, as the court was indicating in the prior thing, it is completely non-controversial, both under state law and under federal constitutional law, that when you have a sort of enhancing factor, whatever you want to call it, in a statute like this, that must be an element of the offense. So there is no plausible textual argument that what's created here is something other than an element of the offense. And therefore, because there's a separate and distinct element, as the Court of Appeals said in the Ladner case, what an element is an essential fact that must be proven in order to establish guilt for the crime, and the elements define the offense. Because there's a separate element set forth in paragraph 1 of subsection 3, there's also, of necessity, a separate offense. It's a greater included offense of the lesser base offense of misdemeanor stealing. So there's four or five elements that are set forth for the base offense in subsection 3, and there's one additional element that is added to that offense that must be proven to establish guilt of the more specific, distinct crime of stealing over $500.
Couldn't they have written that more clearly?
I freely concede that the statute could have been drafted better. And the way that the way that this is drafted in the comparator statutes we've cited in our briefs, like the sexual offense statutes, the assault first statute, where they use the word unless, would be perhaps a clearer way to do it. But the only lack of clarity here is created by the fact, to the extent there is any, is created by the fact that the subsection 3, the sort of threshold criteria, is satisfied by something that happens lower on the page, essentially. In other words, subparagraph 1 appears later in the statute rather than earlier. But this doesn't change the plain meaning of the statute. There's nothing sort of unusual, just from the perspective of the English language, about having a threshold criterion satisfied by something that you say later on as opposed to earlier.
And do we have to overrule Bissell to agree with that, or is Bissell says it's unambiguous that doesn't apply in the firearm situation?
That is correct, and absolutely not. Bissell would remain good law under this interpretation. First of all, Bissell expressly declined to consider and decide the specific interpretive question that's before the court in these cases. Bissell in footnote 4 said this issue wasn't properly preserved, so we are not deciding it in this particular case. Further, the petitioners, and to an extent the Court of Appeals, have lifted that one sentence in the Bissell opinion, in the state's view, out of context. Because it does seem to refer to misdemeanor stealing, there's been this conclusion that subsection 3 must be referring solely back to subsection 1 when it talks about any offense having an element. But that couldn't have been the court's holding in Bissell, because as the court observed, the 3D, the enhancing factor that was issued in Bissell, is any firearms. And value, in other words, a dollar threshold, value is not an element of that particular more specific offense.
So did Bissell create new law?
Yes, the state's position is Bissell absolutely did create new law.
And your opponent argues otherwise.
That is correct.
Explain why you think it creates new law.
I would turn the court's attention to its own opinion in the Stewart case. The Stewart case is precisely on all fours with this particular case. In Stewart, Stewart itself actually applied a new interpretation of the DWI, persistent offender enhancement statute, to hold that under the plain language of that statute, this court in Stewart said the legislature probably didn't intend this. It's very similar to Bissell, but the phrase was within, the two prior offenses had to occur within 10 years of the previous offense. And this court said previous offense, that means there's got to be a third one, which is absolutely correct as a matter of interpretation. So, and this court was overruling a prior judicial decision, as Bissell overruled Passley. The Stewart case had overruled the prior Miles decision from the Court of Appeals.
So every one of our decisions where we overrule some earlier case is prospective only, that's going to change a lot of law in Missouri, because we do not so hold. Most cases come here because there's a conflict in prior cases, because we have to overrule some prior case. But we don't say our decisions are then prospective only in all those instances.
I agree with that, Your Honor. I would say that the general rule is that when it's a substantive decision, as this decision is, the retroactive effect, there is retrospective effect, but it's limited to cases that are still pending.
So what law changed? The statute remained the same.
Right, but there was an authoritative judicial interpretation that
not
found...
Not by this court.
That's correct. By the Court of Appeals that bound every trial court and the state, all across the state. And in addition, there were Missouri-approved charges that are promulgated by this court, even though they don't have the same authoritative effect, that were also overruled. And there was a prior line of cases in the Court of Appeals going all the way back to 2002 and before, acknowledging, you know, in a kind of ho-hum fashion, so to speak, that this is a Class C felony and includes value as an element. And I'd emphasize that the court need not decide the retroactivity issue in these cases, because the court can, and in fact should, resolve this case on the issue of interpretation. The interpretive issue is very clear. This clearly is a felony. It's a separate offense that has an additional element. Because it's a greater included offense, it is a distinct offense within the meaning of subsection 3. And because it's a distinct offense, it's therefore any offense that has value as an element. Because there is a distinct offense created by this statute that unquestionably has value as an element, for the reasons the court was indicating, this paragraph 1 unquestionably is a value element enhancing factor, then this is, in other words, the logic of Bazell does not extend to this particular case. So the sort of, in a sense, thornier question of retroactivity need not be addressed and decided in this case, because the state is entitled to win on the basis of the interpretive grounds alone.
What's the impact of the language in subsection 3, if any impact, notwithstanding any other provision of law?
I don't believe it has any impact on the conclusion that there is a separate offense here. To the extent that that has impact, I believe that what it does, it would be another reason to foreclose the petitioner's interpretation, which wants to give a more narrower focus, more narrower reference to the language that follows. So that's a broad language saying any offense, notwithstanding any other provision of law, any offense that has value as an element. And because there is a greater included offense that's defined in the statute right there in the plain text, that includes a value element. For that reason, this court should conclude that stealing over $500 remains a Class C felony after Bazell under the prior interpretation of the statute. And I would caution the court against accepting the argument that the legislative revision is somehow an admission of error. First, that legislative revision happened as a part of a major routine codification, and in fact, it was enacted prior to Bazell, so in no way was a reaction to Bazell. But further, courts of appeal have said on many occasions that very difficult to read the tea leaves of you know, legislature's actions and failure to act. The court should focus on the plain language of this statute that is before it, the statute that was in effect from 02 to 17. And there's a separate offense that's created. That offense unquestionably has value as an element, and therefore it is any offense that has value as an element. The petitioner's interpretive position is essentially, well, it really must have meant any base offense or any offense that's defined higher on the page than subsection 3, but those are qualifications that are not present in the plain language of the statute.
Do you agree? You indicated in response to Judge Stitt's questions that we would not have to overrule Bazell, but do you agree that there is pretty broad language in Bazell that would be contrary to the argument you're making?
I agree that the sentence, the two sentences, in fact, in the Bazell opinion that the courts of appeals have relied on should be taken in context, because it is understandable that the courts of appeals have read Bazell as interpreting subsection 3 to refer solely to subsection 1. But it's the state's position that they're reading the Bazell opinion out of context. That discussion was in the context of considering the theft of any firearms enhanced offense, where the enhancement also lacks a value as an element. And the central instruction of Bazell is start with the plain text of the statute. You know, the careful analysis of these actual words. What does offense mean? What does element mean? What does the word any mean? That has been absent from the post-Bazell discussions of this particular issue. And I would point out to the court that if the court resolves these questions on the interpretive ground, as the state suggests, it would have major administrative advantages. There have been a large number of habeas petitions filed on these issues, but the vast majority of them are stealing over $500 cases. And the court does consider, when it's in other contexts, for example, in the Whitfield context, the court considers the effect of the administration of justice and so forth when deciding whether or not to apply its decisions retroactively. And certainly those Whitfield factors would decisively call for against retroactive application in this case, where one of them is the extent to which law enforcement was relying on this. Essentially, no lawyer on either side of the V, you know, either a state's attorney, a prosecutor, or as far as we can tell, any criminal defense attorney, or very few criminal defense attorneys, even keyed onto this issue in the 15 years that the statutory language was in effect. So there has been substantial reliance.
Was it in your brief that you indicated there are 12,000 inmates, or maybe it was in one of the relator's briefs, there were 12,000 inmates incarcerated under this provision?
Correct. That was in an affidavit that we submitted to the court at the preliminary stages.
But if we don't find it retroactive, then that's not a relevant consideration, is it?
It's
only relevant if we find we have to apply it retroactively as opposed to that it's a clarification of the law.
That is correct. If this court decides that Bazell was a mere clarification of the law and not a change in the law, this court would be required under Fiore to rule that there's no retroactivity issue at all. But the state strongly urges that this clearly is a change in the law. And I believe that the Thornton case from the Court of Appeals that's principally relied on by the petitioners in all of these cases emphasizes this court's opinion in Severe. And I believe that Severe is distinguishable on at least three grounds, and that's Stewart. Severe and Stewart are in very similar postures. There's situations where a new interpretation of the DWI prior and persistent offender statute has been adopted. Stewart clearly limited its limited the retroactive application to not final, not pending cases. The Severe case, by contrast, didn't address this issue. Neither Turner nor Severe, in neither of those cases, did this court actually address the question of retroactivity, because the posture of Severe, which is the opinion where this court said this was a mere clarification, not a change in the law. The posture of Severe was on a case that was still pending on direct review when Turner had been decided.
What about Zena, Merriweather, and a half dozen other cases that all say if you sentence someone beyond that permitted by law, that's something you can always raise in a habeas proceeding?
The state has not disputed in this case that these claims can be raised in a habeas proceeding, but those cases, to my understanding, do not address the merits question of whether it's actually a change in the law. So, yeah, absolutely, Your Honor.
Back to the question I asked your opposing counsel, why do these claims not have to be brought in a 2915 motion? What does the sentence in 2915, which says sentence imposed was in excess of the maximum authorized by law, What does that mean then? What does it apply to if you don't have to bring these types of claims in the 2915?
It's an excellent question, Your Honor. And in a future case, the state may well press that. In truth and fact, for whatever reason, we haven't raised that issue in this particular case. The court could raise it sua sponte, but the state in its briefs simply has not raised that particular issue, perhaps because we thought that the Zena line of cases and so forth was sufficiently clear. But certainly the state could.
Well, there's no discussion in Zena about the rule. Right, there's no discussion in the Zena case about whether or not the rule applies.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor, and for that reason, I think there would be no obstacle to the court itself raising that issue and treating that as an alternative ground to deny habeas relief in these cases. As you say, the language of the rule is quite clear on that point. If there are no further questions at this time, I'll sit down. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I just wanted to make one observation. Respondents spent a lot of their argument on this issue of subsection 3 referring down to the greater included offense of stealing something of value. But this sort of this downward look was not what the court did in Bazell. It did not look to whatever subsection criminalized or made a felony stealing a firearm and say, well, we find no element of value in that particular subsection, so we cannot find the enhancement. Rather, it looked back to the core offense and found that the element of value was lacking. So again, I think to be consistent.
But it specifically declined to address the $500 conviction because it wasn't preserved, stealing over $500. But
it hadn't been briefed, I think.
It didn't need to address that larger issue here. I agree there's language both sides can pull from Bazell, but certainly the language you're referring to in Bazell was broad, but Was it obiter dictum? Was it an impression, which clearly the courts of appeals have had, but since that question wasn't before it, it seems almost like you're arguing it was binding on a fact situation not before the court in Bazell.
Well, I mean, the court, you know, the court in doing its analysis of the statute and making it, in trying to interpret the statute, not through means of statutory interpretation, but just reading the plain language, obviously, it seems to have read any offense as referring back to subsection 1. And I think that was necessary for the resolution of the Bazell case. Say strongly enough, this court did not create new law because it's really not this court's function to create new law. It's the legislature's function to create new law. It's this court's function to interpret it.
And I asked the state whether there were, in fact, 12,000 individuals incarcerated under the statute that you're suggesting would all be wrongfully convicted. Does that number influence us as to whether there's a change in the law? That if, in fact, there has been a history for a significant period of time and that number of convictions, is that a factor in determining whether it is a change in the law?
I say it's not a factor in determining whether it's a change in the law, whether it should motivate this court one way or the other. It seems to me that it should motivate the court to grant relief to Ms. Windeconnect and others like her because of the magnitude of the problem. I think that when in balancing the equities, it is the person who's incarcerated, wrongfully so, under the statute as we now understand it.
And if we get to a point of interpreting, I'll go back to my first question to you. Is it apparent from the statute that the legislature intended for someone stealing over $500 in property for that to be a felony?
I think that was their intent. I wouldn't argue with that. That you know there had been a crime of stealing over in 2002 for reasons that I failed to understand, and this court failed to understand. They changed that language when they amended the statute in 2002. So this court was obligated to read the statute as written. I mean, the respondent invites the court to make the same error here that the Southern District did in the Pasley case, to look at what is a logical result, what the legislature intended, and not look at the plain language. This problem could have been corrected in 2012, but the court leapt over the analysis of plain language.
Thank you. The case will be submitted.